This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we call our show Main Street because our microphones create a virtual Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And those real ones that we love to cross are like a virtual Main Street, except we get to greet people and say hello to them and share our news and opinions. And today, we're going to greet somebody named Leticia Mazzero-Hellerud, who has written a brand new book, Being at Home in the World, Cross-Cultural Leadership Lessons to Guide Your Journey. And what a journey it has been for you, Leticia. Thanks for being with us.
Yes, indeed. Thank you.
So why did you write the book?
Thank you, Doug, for having me on the show. I wrote the book mostly because because I thought that my journey was so unique, has been so unique, and that I've collected so many lessons that I could pass along to my fellow Fargoan and fellow Americans and beyond.
And your life journey begins, this story starts in Burundi, it goes to France, Rwanda, Burkina Faso, and then ultimately to Fargo, and that is a heck of a journey. So tell us about your homeland, your original homeland, Burundi.
Okay. Burundi is a beautiful, small, landlocked country in the heart of Africa. So we actually like to call ourselves the heart of Africa, but we are directly south of Rwanda, and Rwanda is the same size, almost same size as Burundi, and we do dispute sometimes that title of being the heart of Africa. So anyway, Burundi is the size of Maine. We have the largest, not largest, but the deepest lake in the world, after Lake Baikal in the former USSR. Lake Tanganyika is, beautiful and deep, and yes, the second deepest lake in the world. And we have, the landscape is really, really beautiful. It's varied. We have mountains, we have plateaus, we have plains, we have, what else do we have? We have mainly two distinguishable seasons. Still say four seasons, but you will not feel the difference of the transition of seasons. So we have usually the dry season and the wet season. And what else can I say about Burundi?
Well, what's the basis of the economy of the country?
Agriculture. Mm-hmm. Agriculture and mostly sustaining, agriculture. So people grow what they eat and what they feed their family.
And you're just south of Rwanda, and Burundi, like Rwanda, has two primary tribal groups, the Hutus and the Tutsis, right?
That's right. That's right. And in both countries, Burundi and Rwanda, the Tutsis are the minority in terms of numbers, and the Hutus have been the majority in terms of numbers again. But unlike Rwanda and Burundi, when we think about, those two ethnic groups have not been living peacefully together over the years. And it's kind of confusing sometimes, because in Burundi, the minority Tutsi, Tutsis were in power most of the time. And then in Rwanda, the majority Hutus. Mm. So the minority Tutsis in Burundi have been in power over the years, and the majority Hutus in Rwanda have been in power.
And your father was Hutu, your mother was Tutsi.
Yes.
What did your father do?
My father did a little bit of everything. By trade, he was an artist, and he worked in education most of the time with the Department of Education, and was at some point the head of the art school in my hometown, Gitega. And he was also a writer. He did write a book. It's a compilation of artists and their work in Burundi. And that's a published book. But he also wrote another book that was a novel, but fiction, but really not fiction, because it's a love story, his love story with my mother. And that one is not published yet. I'm going to say yet. So, my father was also a politician, and he actually did run for president of Burundi in 1994.
All right. Yeah. After the second Burundian genocide.
Actually, 1993.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, there have been, of course, a couple of upheavals of
yes.
note that you write about in the book, because that's how you became a refugee.
Yes.
There was a genocide.
Yes.
In Burundi and ultimately in Rwanda and then
yes.
again in Burundi again.
Yes.
Between Hutus and Tutsis.
Yes. And it's much more complex than that, Doug, because, some people will dispute again whether it was a genocide or not, especially in 1972. It's controversial.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some criteria that have to be met for a war or like a political conflict to be categorized as a genocide. And, in 1972, there's like Le Marchand, René Le Marchand is a renowned historian. He called the Burundian crisis in 1972 the forgotten genocide. And there are some other historians who will come from a different angle and say, dispute that, But in 1993 has not been categorized as a genocide, the crisis that was in Burundi. And I think, unfortunately, there are many people who die, and it's not necessarily one ethnic group. In 1993, I'm going to say that it was completely different situation than 1992.
Letitia Mazera-Hellerud is the author of Being at Home in the World, Cross-Cultural Leadership Lessons to Guide Your Journey. And when I went through the book, I discovered that Letitia, sublime joy,
yes.
Mazera, hope.
Hope.
So let's go back to when you're 5 years old and when that seems almost ironic because you are fleeing your country to get to Rwanda.
Yes. Yes, and that time, so the conflicts in Rwanda and Burundi have not always, they were not at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So we would have a conflict in Burundi and maybe not in Rwanda. But 1993, 1994, early 90s, the Great Lakes region in general was going through a turmoil. But let's go back to 1973 when I was fleeing from Burundi with my mother and my two siblings, my oldest brother, Jean-Claude, and my sister, Nadine, who's younger than me. My father had gone to France on a scholarship. So for education before the crisis started, before the war started, and actually at that time we were living in Bujumbura, where I was born. But when my father went to France, my mom was a stay-at-home mother, so he thought that it would be more practical to go back to stay with grandma, with her parents. In the hills of Mutana, so my mom took us to stay with our grandparents and uncles, and actually that was my best time. If I think about all the places where I've lived, that's almost unduplicable.
Mm-hmm.
That was I was like a young and like a child and carefree and just no, almost like no rules, really, because we were roaming day in, day out, no fear of cars and, people stealing children, kidnapping children. So we would just be expected to be home at meal times. And one night, without any warning, my mom came and woke us up and we had to leave. And it's a very traumatic time, probably the most traumatic in my four episodes of becoming refugees, and mostly because I was so young and it was happening in a culture where not much is shared with children, and we didn't ask questions, and it was dark, and it was scary. And my uncle, my oldest uncle, took us in his truck, and we went to the Kanyaru River that borders Rwanda and Burundi, and two men who were with my uncle helped us cross, and up to this date, it's very hard for me to even talk about.
Well, your book does have several instances where you are met with the kindness of strangers.
Yes.
And frankly, crossing that river, you meet one of them, a woman who takes you in.
Yes, yes. And I don't even know if it's a woman or a man.
Uh-huh.
It was dark. It was when we crossed the river, we knocked at the hut that was on the other side, on the Rwanda side, and somebody opened. My mom just said, please give us a place to stay. We are fleeing. And somebody opened the door. And it's not unusual in the Burundian and Rwandan or African culture for people to let a stranger stay overnight, because we don't have like motels like in the villages. I guess people take care of each other. But that was at a time when, again, I had never experienced that. I always stayed home with my parents or my grandparents. Or when we went to visit, it was planned, and we would stay at places where I knew the people. So this was my first early encounter with kindness from a stranger.
And I come across this word in your book quite often, imana.
Imana, yes.
And that's word
God.
For God?
Yes, that's God in Kirundi.
So what religious faith were you raised in?
I was raised a Catholic. I actually thought that everybody was Catholic until I came to Fargo. So, well, that's an exaggeration. But, you know, yes, Roman Catholicism has been the most predominant religious group in Burundi. And it has been changing, I guess, after 1994, 1994, 1995, we've seen many groups, still Christian groups and different denominations. But for a long time, we had at least 68% of Catholics.
Now, eventually or quickly, the family, and you're young, and Jean-Claude's older, and your mother and Nadine.
Yes.
You get to Kigali, the capital of Rwanda.
Yes.
And there is a terrible accident.
Yeah.
With your brother.
Yeah.
And again, this strange kindness of strangers happens again.
Yes. You know, we were, so my mother would leave us in this motel, and she was trying to get passport for us to go to France, because the government of Burundi refused to give her the passport. They would say, let the father come and get his children. But she knew it was a trap. So when we were in Kigali, mom left us in the room, and would tell us to make sure to pretend that it was empty. She didn't want to take us to the embassy or you know, some other random government offices, because she didn't want us to be part of that conversation around fleeing. And she wanted to protect us as much as possible. But she was also and this is something that she told me later as I was writing this book. She said, I didn't want you to see my emotions that I couldn't control, she was getting rejections after rejections.
Your mother is still alive. She's in Toronto.
She's in Toronto, yes.
Your father passed away in Burundi.
Yes, in Burundi, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, your brother is injured in a car accident. He survives, and he's okay, sort of, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. He's okay. And the woman who hit her actually ended up being our salvation to getting those passports. The woman who hit her was connected to a high official of the immigration department in Rwanda, and she was instrumental to us getting the documents.
So eventually, you get to France.
Yes.
How long are you in France?
We lived in France, I'm going to say, 5-6 years. Yeah.
And Were you in a refugee environment there, or what?
No.
How did you live?
My father was a student, so we lived in a low income housing place, and eventually he finished school and worked some, and we still with the three children and one working parent. It was still very hard, and my father decided that maybe we should go and be refugees closer to home in Rwanda, and where also the cost of living was more affordable. And it's not. I don't even think that he had a choice really, because it was not easy to get even as refugees, it was not easy to get the support that he needed. We needed.
You speak French, though.
Oui. I do. My children do too.
Yes, it's charming when you the way they refer to you in the book.
Yeah.
But you get to Burkina Faso.
Yes.
What was that? How did you end up there?
Gosh. So eventually, after we lived in Rwanda and eventually we decided to go back home to Burundi. And then I went to college. I went to high school. I went to college and was married and had a son. And with the new crisis, and although I was kind of used to live in the ups and downs of fleeing and stabilizing, there is something that shifts when you are a mother. Mm-hmm. I didn't want my son to grow up in that kind of environment where you can't dream about tomorrow.
Because about now there's this other uprising happening
in Burundi. Yes.
And so you leave Burundi, you go to Burkina Faso,
yes.
And you are literally in a refugee camp then, aren't you?
Actually I was so lucky. I didn't. I was not in a refugee camp. I was an urban refugee.
Ah.
Yes, an urban refugee. So somebody who still has the protection from the UNHCR to be a refugee, and it's a very extensive process. But I lived in town. I was very lucky to have a job, and I was able to support my brothers and sisters, but my family was also could afford to help us be in schools. So we were lucky nobody had school interrupted, yes.
Well, now let's get you to Fargo.
Yes.
Because it's 1998.
1998.
How did you get to Fargo?
Wow. Well, I applied for resettlement as one of the durable solutions that the UNHCR has for refugees is either repatriation, when the conditions are right, you go back, or local integration in your first country of asylum. For me, it was Burkina Faso, or very few, like 2%, can be considered for resettlement. Mm-hmm. And I was considered, my family was brought to Fargo as resettled refugees. I don't even know where to start because that was another big shock.
Well, I would say that it couldn't be much more of a big shock. You're coming from Burkina Faso, which is a very hot place.
Yes, yes, over 100 degrees
to
at that time. To
Fargo.
Yes, end of September.
Okay.
And people were still wearing like light, clothes and I'm surprised because I'm looking at myself how I'm dressed now. You should have seen me in 1998. I'm sure I had like layers, so it was a shock. The weather for sure, and it got worse and worse and worse and worse, and then also the lifestyle. Everything was new. Everything was. It was completely different. I don't even know. So it was overwhelming.
So that is an important cross-cultural lesson.
Indeed.
To share with people.
Yes.
The kind of cultural shock you have coming from place A to place B. In this case, that's Fargo.
Yes.
Well, you had good formal education.
Yes.
And you said
about... I want
about,
to think so.
Well, you said about wanting to make a life for yourself. And
yes.
You've got kids.
Yeah. I had my son, who was then like 3 years old, and my three sisters and my youngest brother. And my youngest brother was probably 13 when we got here. And Claudette, that's Olivier, and Claudette was like 15. And then Aline was 17 or 18.
I can't remember. You're the matriarch now.
I am. And so I'm a young mom at that time. And I have like a family of teenagers, and my sister Nadine is only a few years younger than me, but I'm the responsible person now, and I'm not equipped at all, not as a mother, and not as a mother in a culture that's not even my own. Mm-hmm. So that's another lesson that I had to learn, how to raise children in a culture that's not yours, and how to accept to be like a good enough parent or good enough, you know, person, and not the person who's always striving for perfection that I've always been.
Well, you had a husband that
yes.
was back mm-hmm. in Africa.
Yeah.
Eventually, you divorced, which is an unusual process in itself
yes,
for
yes.
your
mm-hmm.
culture.
Yeah.
And now you have a new last name eventually, Hellerud.
Yes, a Norwegian name, right?
So how did that happen?
I think that's the integration at its best. That's how I like to call it. Well, I met Mark through mutual friends, and I, you know, liked his smart and his sense of humor. And if you know Mark, he can be funny and sometimes too funny for his own good. But you know,
Leticia Mazzaro yes. Hellerud is the author of Being at Home in the World: Cross Cultural Leadership Lessons to Guide Your Journey. She's our guest here on Main Street today, and there's a very touching piece in the book here where your daughter
yes.
wants to go to a dance.
Yes.
And you're thinking, oh, no.
No.
That's just wrong.
Yeah. He's in fifth grade.
And your son wants to go to prom.
Yes.
But your daughter writes this essay.
Yes.
That convinces you that, we should try this.
Yes. You know, my children learned to be resourceful. And because I was so busy working more than, two jobs at a time. And at some point, I was also going to graduate school. And so they learned to find ways to get what they wanted by educating me about, you know, what it was. So she wrote a beautiful essay. Actually, it's in the book. I hope, you read it. I hope the listeners read the book. But she convinced me, because she did not leave anything out, you know, from a title like Trust and Responsibility to like a beautiful introduction and great development and really convincing, solid conclusion. So, yes, when she wrote the essay, and I had to give her the $5 that she needed, and she was, you know, jubilant, and yeah.
Oh, there's a very touching anecdote, too, where you're out of money. This is before the kids are much younger, and
yeah.
you go to the Presentation Sisters Convent in
yes,
Fargo,
yes.
and they help you in a yeah. very very touching way. So
yes.
it's, again, the kindness of strangers in yeah. this cross-cultural
yes.
discussion that
yes.
we're having right now, sort of embodied by that. You say there are a couple of headings in the book that really caught my attention, so I'd want you to expand on them in a couple minutes we have left here. It's Fargo chose us and Fargo welcomed us. In
yeah.
what way?
In what way? When we were told that we're going to Fargo, I don't think I had ever heard of Fargo. So I did not write Fargo or North Dakota on my application for resettlement. So I feel like karma or Fargo decided that we were coming here.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anytime I say Fargo, we didn't choose to come to Fargo. Fargo chose us, you know, 19 years after, I always also talk about my love story with Fargo. And Fargo welcomed us. We wanted safety. We came here for safety and opportunities, and we got much more than that. The love, the kindness, the family and friends that we were able to meet on this journey, and we were able to rebuild a family starting from my blended Norwegian family now, but my family of friends, my colleagues from different organizations where I worked, people who took a chance in hiring me from when they had not even heard of Burundi, people who mentored me and mentored my brothers and sisters, people who sent a jacket home with my sister on a winter day when she went to school not properly dressed. So yeah, we think that Fargo did a beautiful job restoring our dignity and showing us that you can trust strangers.
Well, sometimes it's helpful if we can't actually have the experience to read somebody's story of that experience, and yours is very worthwhile reading. It Being at Home in the World, Cross-Cultural Leadership Lessons to Guide Your Journey. The author is Leticia Mazzero-Hellerud. Thank you for being our guest today.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
Now the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A judge has sentenced a Fargo man to life in prison without parole for the murders of two men and to setting fire to one of the victim's apartments. Ashley Hunter stabbed a friend, Clarence Flowers, 77 times. Samuel Trout was beaten with a hammer. Hunter's attorney called the killings murder in the moment that were the result of meth-induced rage. Sally Trout, the sister of Samuel Trout, says it's hard to explain when someone asks whether she has any siblings.
Do I go into details with a complete stranger I'm meeting for the first time? So this has become the question I dread. I no longer ask that question to others because I know that question most likely will be reciprocated toward me. What used to bring me smiles of joy now leaves me with heartbreaking emptiness. While there are two fatal victims in this horrendous incident about 2 years ago, one cannot begin to count the number of living victims that face this tragedy on a daily basis.
Cass County State's Attorney Birch Burdick argued for the maximum sentence, calling the murders shocking and unusual for this community. Hunter spoke to the families before the sentence was imposed.
You know, there's nothing really I can say or nothing that I can do to take away the pain that they've had to feel throughout this whole ordeal. There's nothing I can really say or there's nothing I can really do to, as much as I would like to reunite them with their loved ones. I wish that I would have been able to take the necessary steps, if you will, to prevent this or intervene or somehow help them or save them, but I could not. I was not able.
District Judge Norman Anderson said the murders were unprovoked and drugs were no excuse for what Hunter did. Those who are attending the 21st Annual United Tribes Technical College Tribal Leaders Summit in Bismarck are considering offering a resolution regarding the disappearance and death of a Fargo woman. It isn't on the formal agenda, but United Tribes President Russ McDonald says he's anticipating formal discussions and a resolution from the summit's board concerning the death of Savannah LaFontaine Graywind. Her body was found in the Red River after being reported missing. She was 8 months pregnant, and her child was found alive in an apartment in the building Graywind lived in. McDonald says the resolution would
help support perhaps national legislation that would help to keep women victims safe, primarily American Indian women.
Two Fargo people, Brooke Cruz and William Hain, have been charged in Graywind's murder. The Tribal Leaders Summit runs through Friday. And as we transition from summer activities to more autumn-related ones, officials from the Great Plains Food Bank are doing the same. Chief Development Officer Marsha Paulson says the start of the school year marks another year of the after-school backpack program.
We put together food packs, distribute them every week to the school, and then the school gets that food directly to the needs of children who are in need.
Paulson says the program works nicely with the food bank's school pantry program. She says in both cases, they work with partners within the schools to identify students in need of assistance. Paulson says the program comes on the heels of another successful youth summer meals program. Under summer meals, children can get a meal during the summer months.
This program has grown and evolved across North Dakota. We operate several sites in our state, but we're not the only program that does that. At our sites, we saw 25, 30 kids every day who were coming for a meal that they could count on.
Paulson says one bonus they saw this summer was fresh produce. She says farmers from the region donated the produce, allowing organizers to put together a pop-up farmer's market. Paulson says that allowed children to have fresh produce they otherwise may not have had. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Hi, I'm Cassie Shipley, Donor Relations Coordinator for Prairie Public. If you're a sustaining member, we can't thank you enough. Your generous monthly contribution provides a reliable source of funding so we can bring you high-quality programming and fact-based, independent journalism. Plus, you help bring down the costs of mailing out pledge reminders. And of course, it's greener for the environment. So we know you enjoy the little extra benefit of saving Prairie Public money. But here's where we could use your help again. Expired and renewed credit cards can stop a sustaining membership in its tracks. But that can't happen when you set up your monthly deduction via a checking account. So make the switch. All we need is your bank's routing number and your account number. That's it. So make your monthly gift to Prairie Public count even more by switching your sustaining membership to a checking account monthly deduction. It's easy to do. Just call me, Cassie Shipley, at 800-359-6900, extension 538, or email at sustainer@prairiepublic.org.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Sidney, Nebraska has prospered at a time when many rural towns have struggled. For decades, it's been home to Cabela's, a major outdoor retail chain. But today, the future of Sidney's economic engine is in doubt. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach looks at where Sidney and other rural towns fit in the 21st century economy.
Hear ye, hear ye! The proclamation for the birthday party.
It's Sidney, Nebraska's 150th birthday. Wendell Gaston is a city councilman and pharmacist at the local Safeway. He stands at the balcony of the city's first building, Camp Lookout. It's trimmed with red, white, and blue bunting.
That the birthday party of the 150 years of both the state of Nebraska and the city of Sidney begin.
But even with a parade, street dance, and carriage rides all to celebrate Sidney's history, people here can't help but look forward with some worry. Across the valley from Camp Lookout is the sprawling headquarters of Cabela's. The outdoor and hunting retailer has been based here in western Nebraska since the 1960s. Now Cabela's is in the last stages of selling itself to Bass Pro Shops, based in Springfield, Missouri. It's a $5.5 billion deal.
We had a situation where Wall Street stepped in to a situation that's not Wall Street.
I caught up to John Phillips at the local car show. Phillips runs the Fox Theater, a two-screen movie house downtown. He expects Bass Pro to keep workers in Sidney. But out of the nearly 7,000 people who live here, around 2,000 work at Cabela's. Bass Pro has not said how many will stay. Around town, business has been down at times.
Because people are scared. You know, there's scared money. So people aren't spending money. But for the most part, people are back to doing business as normal. You know, it's not a town that is a dust town.
So you have this rural city that has thrived with the presence of one big company. But now relying on that one company could really crush the town.
There's no doubt that the community will start to feel impacts.
Susanna Nardi is with Rural LISC, a nonprofit that works with towns around the country on housing and economic development.
The grocery stores, you know, the bowling alleys, and no doubt the school districts, you know, the hospital. It just goes on and on and on.
And Nardi's advice for rural towns like Sidney is to make an extra effort to play to their strengths, work to bring in businesses that match the local workforce. Sidney has added 4 businesses in the last 6 months, but it's mostly blue-collar work, good jobs, just not the skills or salary that match many ex-Cabela's employees. Melissa Norgard is the city's economic development director. That Cabela's workforce is a big part of her recruiting pitch to new businesses.
Even though it's negative in the news that there might be job loss and there will be foreclosures on houses and things like that, you know, we have a lot of very talented people that work here that are going to stay here.
But recruiting white-collar jobs is harder in rural areas. Chuck Schroeder heads the Rural Futures Institute at the University of Nebraska. He says many companies on the level of Cabela's stick closer to big cities with big airports and upscale amenities. So he says don't count on them.
The renaissance will come from within, not from without. When it comes from within, it'll draw from without. That's the truth, and that's the way these things work.
Ultimately, if a rural city wants to grow, Schroeder says the people who live there have to invest in the community.
Those things don't just happen. They happen because the community says, yeah, we've had tough times, but you know what? We love this place, and we're going to make it better.
Back at Camp Lookout, Wendell Gaston says after 150 years, it's a good time to remember Sidney's history.
Fort Sidney was here, and when it closed down, they said, all Sidney will dry up. We didn't. Then we had the Sioux Army Depot, which had over 2,000 employees. And they said, well, when it goes, Sidney will go. Didn't happen. And so it's not like we've died. It's just that we've turned over a new leaf, and sometimes that's painful.
Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration with a focus on rural issues. Coming up, we'll have another highlight from this year's TEDx Fargo. We'll hear from Wendy Gillis, CEO of the Kaufman Foundation.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by U.S. Bank. proud to provide banking financing options for businesses. Learn more from local U.S. Bank small business specialists or at usbank.com/quickloan. Subject to credit approval, equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Wendy Gillis is the CEO of one of the largest private foundations in the country. The Kauffman Foundation encourages entrepreneurship and supports education. This year at TEDx Fargo, she spoke about the divisiveness in our country and made a case for more activism from those who see themselves in the middle.
I'm dedicating this talk to everyone in the middle. And by middle, I mean my fellow Midwesterners, as well as anyone living anywhere who approaches life from the middle of the road rather than from the extremes. We all know those middle stereotypes, don't we? Flavor country, vanilla, ordinary. Well, I don't believe those words apply any longer, if they ever did. In fact, I'll go one step further. I believe that the middle is the new edge. You're the people who can solve today's big problems and launch tomorrow's new ideas to move this society forward. There's evidence this is already happening, which I'll share. But first, let me tell you what I know from my own personal experience. So I'm about as middle as they come. I was born and raised in the heartland, in Kansas and Nebraska, not far from the geographic center of the United States. I'm middle-aged. I drive a mid-sized sedan that I park in front of my mid-sized house. Politically and socially, moderate middle. Even on my personality assessments, I score in the middle of the scale, halfway between extrovert and introvert, creative versus analytical, flexible versus rigid. I've spent my life in the middle, and that's not just geography. It's a mindset, a temperament, and a perspective on life. So right about now, you might be wondering, how did someone like me become the head of a $2 billion organization, one of the most innovative and influential foundations in the country? I mean, let's face it, most leaders and innovators are viewed as unusual people with exceptional skills. I used to think that too. After I graduated from the University of Nebraska, I moved to Southern California. And man, I could not wait to leave my heartland roots behind. It was going to be a fresh start for me. I was going to be an L.A. girl. People out there would ask me, so where are you from? And I'd kind of shrug them off and say, oh, it doesn't matter. You know, I'm just from somewhere in the middle. Well, my Valley Girl accent has long since faded, and I'm a lot wiser now. And I've realized that my middleness is nothing to be embarrassed about. It's not a liability. It's an asset, and it can be for you, too. So let's break this down. Just what does this middleness mean to me? I've got 4 points. First, it means being centered. We people in the middle don't get too carried away with extreme emotions. I think it's the weather in the Midwest, right? It's taught us that when a storm in life hits, it's best to keep a level head. Second, we middle grounders tend to be practical. Rather than buying into some magic bullet philosophy, we're more interested in what works, which is usually a combination of a number of approaches. Coming from the middle also means having a healthy sense of humility. Of course we have egos. We just don't focus on feeding them. Rather than doing flashy, provocative things that draw attention to ourselves, we try to collaborate and draw others in to create solutions with us. In this time of extremes in our country, that is a very valuable quality. And in fact, there's research that backs this up. According to the Center for Creative Leadership, the ideal leaders are people who can foster learning and collaboration in changing times. And I think we can all agree in our country now, we need people more than ever who can build that kind of common ground. Finally, we're resilient. We don't blame others for our problems or get defeated by setbacks. Instead of making excuses, we try to make it better. There's a quote I love that comes, and I think it kind of describes the essence of this concept, and it comes from the U.S. president who made the Dakotas his second home, Teddy Roosevelt. He said, "Do what you can with what you have from where you are." There's evidence that this spirit has reemerged in the Midwest in a new and powerful way. At the Kauffman Foundation, we study and support entrepreneurship. And while startup activity in the U.S. is half of what it was a generation ago, our data show that entrepreneurs are making a comeback, and the mid-country states are playing the role of the comeback kids. So of the 10 metro areas with the biggest jumps in entrepreneurial activity last year, 6 are in the middle of the country. What's the city with the highest percentage of women-owned businesses? Denver. And the picture is even more encouraging when you look at the kinds of new ventures that are being launched by people in the middle, because not all of them are chasing just the hottest trends that cater to the 1%, like digital juice machines or whatever. We're seeing everyday people attacking everyday problems and turning them into positives. Here's one of my favorite examples. So the Mississippi River watershed has a problem with an invasive species of fish called Asian carp. Now, Asian carp are different than common carp, and it turns out they taste good. So Vietnamese immigrant Lula Lu started a company in Paducah, Kentucky, to solve this problem. Fin Gourmet contracts with people to fish for Asian carp, hires unemployed individuals to do the processing, and then sells a variety of fish products, very creatively branded as Kentucky Blue Snapper, to restaurants and consumers. As a result, they're turning an environmental issue into an industry, putting people to work, and reducing our reliance on imported foods. Another example is from my hometown. In Return Strategies was started by Kansas City businessman Jim Atwater. Jim is hearing impaired. He realized that many of the country's disabled workers are highly capable, but about 70% of them are unemployed. So his firm places people with disabilities into jobs where they can thrive, and that business is growing too. Our country still needs plenty of high-tech scientific startups. And look, I've got nothing against fancy apps or juice machines. But at the Kauffman Foundation, we're giving increased attention to grassroots startups that are solving everyday problems. We believe our country's best path forward for the long term is to produce more new ventures of every kind. Studies show that startups punch way above their weight when it comes to creating jobs, innovation, and opportunity in our economy. In fact, most net job creation in this country comes from firms that are less than 5 years old. The good news is this momentum in the middle goes beyond starting companies. We're seeing people coming together to solve problems in other interesting ways. Like in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where a high school teacher and a group of citizens decided, hey, let's do something about the fact that our education system is a little out of touch with modern reality. So they created the Iowa Big School, a new public high school built on an entirely different model. Big school students spend a lot of their time working on real-world projects, like creating a virtual reality display for a history museum, or improving inventory flow at a local distribution company. One student worked with a mentor in the garment industry to design clothing for women who aren't shaped like fashion models, while other students are working with architects and engineers on city planning issues. The common theme with Fin Gourmet, In Return Strategies, and the Big School is that none of them came from certified big thinkers and elite enclaves. They came from middle Americans, proving you don't have to be extremely gifted, extremely famous, or extremely anything to make a big difference in the world. It's all a matter of seeing what is and seeing what could be, and then doing what you can with what you have from where you are. At the Kauffman Foundation, we draw inspiration from our founder, Ewing Kauffman, who was a great entrepreneur in his own right. Mr. Kauffman called himself a common man who did uncommon things. In my role as CEO of the foundation, I strive to be a common person who enables uncommon results. My middleness is the core of who I am, and I know now that it is my greatest strength. I encourage you to embrace your middle self and make it a strength for you too. Our country will thank you. because there is no shortage of good work to be done. As great as our society is, it is still far from what it could be. I believe it'll be you, the grounded, practical, collaborative people who live and approach life in the middle, who will play a big role in taking us there. You are the reason that the middle is the new edge.
Kauffman Foundation CEO Wendy Gillis speaking at this year's TEDx Fargo. Next on Main Street, an excerpt from Gutes Essen, Prairie Public's newest documentary.
Have you ever wondered why people do bad things? International crime analyst Tom Gash will dispel the myths we hold about the causes of crime to get to the truth behind criminal activity. The conversation starts at the Game Changer Ideas Festival on September 23rd in Bismarck. Tickets available at GameChangerND.com.
The traditions of an ethnic group are often expressed and handed down through unique foods and recipes. There is nothing more evocative of where one came from than the aromas emanating from the family kitchen. Gutes Essen, good eating in German-Russian country, celebrates the food culture of the Germans from Russia. The food is great, but the stories are even better.
The much-anticipated Prairie Public original Gutes Essen premieres Thursday, September 7th at 7 p.m. Central, 6 Mountain, on the television service of Prairie Public.
And speaking of Gutes Essen, today on Main Street we have an excerpt featuring one of the voices in the new documentary. Carolyn Spurley talks about her family's immigration to North Dakota.
My name is Carolyn Spurley from Napoleon, North Dakota. Now I'm going to show you my Wulst. We lived on a farm about 6 miles northwest of here. I was born there in January the 23rd, 1916. When the priest baptized me, he said, "The smallest baby I ever baptized." Grandpa and his family came on the ship. They came over in April 1911. And when they got to New York, when they looked at Grandpa, they noticed he was blind in one eye. Like you put cattle in the corral, that's what they did to him, and put an X on his shoulder. And then they said, "You can come in, but he can't." Then they had enough money so that they could take care of Grandpa, anybody, you know. So they let him come. And then from there, from New York, they took the train to Lytton because that's where cousins were. After they were there a while, Grandma was standing behind the house crying, "I wish I would be back in Russia, but I don't like the ship." There was an agent there, and he said to our Grandpa, "You can set up a homestead in Napoleon." So they came over, and then they had a homestead. My oldest brother and my oldest sister were born in Russia. And then when I was born, then they called me the little Yankee. In the 30s, when I grew up, this was a German community. I didn't think we were poor because we had chickens, we had pigs, we had cows, so we had milk, and we had everything, you know. There was food on the table, place to sleep, what else did we want? I had a good life.
That's Carolyn Spurley from the new documentary Gutes Essen, Good Eating in German-Russian Country. Tomorrow, Prairie Public's director of television, Bob Dambach, will join us to talk about the project. Dakota Datebook is next.
There are pub crawls. Those are fun. Even zombie crawls. Those are a little scary. And here's one that's fun and educational.
I'll show you how to put some of nature's masterpieces right here on the canvas.
Studio. Rodeo Crawls. It's one of the best events in the Red River Valley area, and it's free. The FM Visual Artists Studio Crawl, October 7th and 8th, noon to 6 p.m.
It's going to sparkle a lot.
You can tour the studios of some of Fargo-Moorhead's most popular artists.
Lately, I've been painting with a lot of metallic paints.
You know, you go to a museum to look at the art.
The juxtaposition of color is amazing.
Well, you can go on the Studio Crawl to look at the artists. Go ahead, they won't bite. See painters, potters, sculptors, a glassblower, all demonstrating their work and talking with you about their lives as working artists.
Just work all the time.
Yes, you can be a working artist, not just a starving artist. Get your Studio Crawl map at prairiepublic.org/events. The FM Visual Artist Studio Crawl, October 7th and 8th, noon to 6.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Daybook for September 5th. The Missouri River was a formidable obstacle to travel in North Dakota. Travelers were thrilled when the situation was resolved. On this date in 1916, traffic in the Williston area saw a most welcome improvement. The Grand Forks Herald announced that both the old and the new channels of the Missouri River had been crossed at Williston using 35 boats and wooden planks to form a pontoon bridge. The project had been finished with remarkable speed, and there were no accidents during construction. Once the materials arrived, the bridge took only a week to complete. Hundreds of spectators arrived every day to watch the construction. The bridge was located at the narrowest point of the river. This resulted in a shorter bridge of only 500 feet, but the river current proved to be a challenge. While the old channel was described as slow and sluggish, the current in the new channel was swift. And that remains the case today. From the Fort Peck Dam to Williston, a distance of 145 miles, the river drops 188 feet, and the current can reach 7 miles per hour. Less than 2 years after construction, the current became too much for the bridge, and it was destroyed by a flood in 1918. A new, more substantial structure was built in 1927, but it eventually proved inadequate for the load of heavier cars and trucks. It was replaced in 1973. As traffic increased in the modern era, the need for a four-lane bridge became clear. The new Lewis and Clark Bridge is part of the U.S. 85 four-lane project, which created 33 miles of four-lane roadway from Watford City to Williston. Originally scheduled for completion in 2016, the bridge was finally opened to traffic in 2017, a far cry from the rickety pontoon structure a century before. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Food prices in the U.S. have fallen for 19 months straight. That's great for consumers, not so great for farmers and grocers.
There are times you know that that day, for that month, you're maybe writing a check for the privilege to go milk your cows. You're not making money.
I'm Rachel Martin. What does it mean when food prices keep falling month after month, and when might they tick back up? That's on the next morning edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Wednesday on Main Street, we'll talk with genealogist Paula Stewart Warren, who will be a featured expert at the 42nd Annual Family History Workshop in Moorhead later this month. We hope you'll join us for that and for a little more Gutes Essen as well. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.